Tonight we are talking about the battle to love God, right? And I think the fascinating thing about this is whether you are believing God or not, I think this is the battle in terms of what we love is something that everyone can think about. Whether you're a hardcore believer, a hardcore skeptic, you can really focus and think about what do you love? What are your desires set upon? What are your hearts set upon? Even as we had that read, did you hear in verse 6? Just have a look back at verse 6 and we're just going to, before we leap in. Verse 6 says, these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. And there's other versions talk about our desires. And we're going to be thinking about our hearts and desires. Now, to be honest, in this passage, a lot of it is about what we battle to kind of avoid. So we're not going to, you know, when I say the battle to love God, we're not going to spend all our time about God. It'll be about the battle for what we avoid a lot of the way. That's just what our passage is talking about. But it is pretty interesting. And you and I live in a really interesting time for this. See, I remember reading a series of articles on how America moved from the society that it was into the society that it is now, where ads just saturate the airspace, the mind space, the lives of people there, and all of us, because you live in the Western world. How did it come about? How did a consumer culture come about? And I remember reading a series of essays on this, and one of them said, I was quoting an American economist and a couple of businessmen at the time, and he was saying, for America's economy really to boom, I mean really to boom, we have to create a culture of desire. You have to create a culture of desire. And that is indeed what they did. And now you and I live in that culture of desire. And we experience that story of desire countless times, day after day, walking to the bus stop, standing at the bus stop, getting on the bus, watching the ad on the bus, watching TV, reading, looking at our email. We experience this narrative of desire, of things that we don't desire, but we now do because they've been shown to us. And we need to be aware of our desires. We need to be conscious of what we're setting our hearts on. And this passage is a great sort of challenge for us. It's about the battle for our love. Will our loves be towards other things, or will they be towards God? Now, just to remind you, and maybe if you weren't here, we're going on 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, and the fascinating thing about it is it's all about idolatry. Or even it's about food that's sacrificed to idols. So, in fact, the last verse we had there, therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. So just to remind you of the kind of cultural context, remember, you know, you cast your mind 2,000 years ago. It's hard for us to get our minds into this. I find this hard. We're just not used to idols and temples and so on. They don't play as big a role in our lives. Back then, you would have had your spectrum of people. Some would have been kind of nominal idol worshippers. You know, they would have kind of done the sacrifices, gone to the temple, sort of said the prayers, and then pretty much got on with their lives and done what they wanted. Others would have been deeply influenced by it. You remember I said the idol would have been in your family home, you know, in the middle of the night when you kind of woke up. It would have slightly perhaps freaked you out when you were younger. Then as you got older, you'd have a slightly weird relationship with it. You'd be, most idolaters don't genuinely think the idol is God. That's a kind of a myth. They know it represents a god that they believe in. And so you would have gone to the temple. You would have perhaps participated to varying degrees if you were full on into it. Some temples had temple prostitutes. Sex was a big part of it. There were orgies. There were all sorts of stuff back then. And you'd often have feasts there. Often. And a lot of the meat in the community kind of came through. It was sacrificed to the idols, and then it was connected to a butcher who was sometimes even connected to the temple, and you could buy meat. So you want to eat meat in society, you had to deal with the fact that it was sacrificed through idols and so on. So it's a pretty big part. And throughout 1 Corinthians, Paul is like just banging on about the dangers of it, and particularly in 1 Corinthians 8. And it seems like what he wants them to be aware of is they become Christians. And the way he describes it in another book, in 1 Thessalonians, he says, you turned from idols to worship the living God. And it could apply as well, 1 Corinthians here, you turned. And his worry is that in their engagement with their society, they'll get sucked back into the things and the loves and desires surrounding idolatry and idol worship. Okay? So, what he does is he gives them a warning case study in verse 10. Big warning case study. Have a look at verse chapter 10 of 1 to 4. Have a look there. He describes their spiritual ancestors. Most of these people were Greeks, probably not Jews. He reminds them of the Exodus, the awesome account when God liberated the Israelites from Egypt, you know, with amazing things, the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, the Passover, the presence of God with them. Look at verses 1 to 4. For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud, that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them. That rock was Christ. Nevertheless, well, what is the nevertheless? No doubt you heard what I was emphasizing. All, Paul's saying they all went through these great experiences. And you kind of think if you'd been back there, that would have been a phenomenal experience. You'd think you'd never forget it. You'd think you'd tell your kids. You'd think it would affect you for the rest of your life. But verse 5, nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. It's pretty full on. They rejected God and God eventually rejects them. And they stand as a warning. As you go through the rest of the Bible, you often hear these people of the Exodus generation held up as a warning sign. Remember them. Remember what happened to them. They're a serious issue. Many at the start, few at the finish. I remember I saw a gift card once, and it said something like, have you ever thought that maybe your purpose in life is to serve as a warning for others? Have you ever thought that? Maybe. It's probably one of those gift cards with like a little kitten hanging onto a branch or something like that. You know, have you ever thought, maybe that's my purpose in life? Well, that was the purpose of this generation. They're a warning to others. Not a nice birthday card, and I didn't give it to someone, but that's the warning. Verse 6 says, look at what he says. Verse 6, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. Verse 11, just in case we missed it, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us. Okay. So before we kind of leap into exactly what he's going to hammer down on with idolatry, just a couple of things to hold in our minds along the way, okay? The Old Testament is not like a kind of computer operating system, Windows. What are we up to? What's Windows up to? What is it? 8? Okay. The Old Testament is not like Windows 7, okay? It's not like Windows. You know, when the new operating system comes, you don't keep a copy of the old one, okay? Maybe you might if you like keeping things like that. Either you can't throw things out or that's what you like collecting, and that sounds awesome for you. But if Windows 8 comes along, you don't keep it or you kind of supersede it. The Old Testament's not like that. New doesn't replace the old. The new fulfills the old in the Old Testament. Jesus fulfills the Old Testament. And so you can only fully get Jesus when you look at what he fulfills in the Old Testament. The Old Testament's kind of a shadow, or it starts the trajectory and then you see where it's going with Jesus. He fulfills it. He says about it in John 5:39, he says, it's the scriptures, and he means the Old Testament, that bear witness to him. And Hebrews 11, I think, talks about it being the shadow. No, it's 10. 10 verse 1 talks about it being the shadow and then Jesus coming being the reality. So verse 6 and 11, they're examples for us. The Old Testament matters. It speaks to us. And another thing just to think about, the Old Testament is not like Windows 7. Also, they're not different testaments with different gods, okay? We kind of often think this. I was watching West Wing. Anyone a West Wing fan? Anyone a West Wing? Maybe it's a little bit, it's a bit depressing. Okay, anyways, you know, political drama sort of thing. I have to sit, watch it with my wife so she can explain everything that's happening because I always miss it. They talk too quickly. They move around. Anyway, she's a great help. But as I watch, one time the president was talking to another guy about his particular faith. And they talked about it. He said, oh, no, not really into the Old Testament. I'm more of a New Testament man. I'm more of a Jesus person. And you kind of get that feel that he's going for. It's a thought in our society, right? The Old Testament's an angry, judgmental God, smiting and smoting and whatever other verbs that are associated with smiting. That's what he's into. Judgment, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then you get Jesus, and Jesus is loving and merciful. He's always cuddling a lamb or something. He's probably got one over his back. You know, he's just talking. He's probably a vegetarian. He'd never eat it. You know, he's just, that's your kind of thing. He's wearing a gown. It's all lovely. Maybe you guys, you know, that's just an urban myth. You can only hold that if you just don't read the Bible. Okay? As soon as you read it, you know Jesus talks about judgment an awful lot. You know that God in the Old Testament is holy. He's also loving. And you know Jesus is also holy and loving. And you know that God in the Old Testament's about judgment, but Jesus is about judgment. The Old Testament's about mercy. And Jesus is about mercy too. And Jesus says, that's about me. So you can't be a Jesus man without being an Old Testament man. But I think it's a challenge when we have these verses read like this. There's some full-on stuff in there. I don't know whether you felt this, but I do feel it as I'm reading through it. Can I just show you some of the bits that kind of jar me? Here they are, verse 5. End of verse 5, their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Whoa. I feel like I'm reading a, what's that guy who wrote The Road? McCormack? Cormac McCarthy? I feel like I'm reading a Cormac McCarthy novel sometimes when I hear that. Their bodies were scattered. Verse 8, 23,000 of them died. Verse 9, some of them did and were killed by snakes. Verse 10, and were killed by the destroying angel. Like, that jars. Doesn't that jar? It jars me. You know, I get a paper cut and I'm like, that hurts. Or I get a blister. I don't want a Band-Aid. Do you know what I mean? Like, this sort of stuff jars me. And I think maybe a natural reaction to reading stuff like this is to kind of respond in a certain way and to be a bit, that's just a bit sort of primitive or barbaric or savage, or it's just not kind of cool that way. You need to be careful here not to absolutize our culture over other ones, over the Bible and over other ways of thinking. I have read some of these parts of the Bible with Christians from Africa and India and so on. You know what? They don't have the same reaction. I think maybe they've seen a bit more of the harshness of life. Maybe they're not as protected and shielded as we are. And I think we need to be pretty careful. Most of us don't want to get colonialistic and imperialistic and look down and say that's all savage and primitive. I don't think we want to do that. And so we really need to leave some room, I think, when you get to here, leave some room for the fact that our reaction to some of this stuff, it might be a cultural conditioning that we have in our society. Might be the result of living in a rich, wealthy, urban, comfortable society. I reckon we just need to leave that possibility open as we hear what we're meant to avoid, because these are warnings. What are we meant to avoid? Well, let's leap into them. What are we meant to avoid? What are we meant to avoid in the way we love? Well, look at verse 7. Look at verse 7 with me. Do not be idolaters. Right? That's at the heart of his warning. Do not be idolaters. People who worship idols. And it's at the end as well, verse 14. Therefore, my friends, flee from idolatry. Well, idolatry is making an image of God and worshiping that as that representation of that God. And idolatry, just even as we kind of start coming to it, it kind of happens in all sorts of ways. I've felt it happen to me on my way here. I was kind of coming out. I'm the sort of person who calculates how much time I'll need to get somewhere and then leaves about a couple of minutes after that. Do you know what I mean? Does anyone else do that? It's like a compulsion I have. I'm always a little bit late. And do you know what happens when I get a little bit late? I start like driving a little bit frantic and I kind of get really annoyed at people who slow down in front of me and I'm like, come on, people, come on, move out of the way. And I have this running conversation going on. It's very embarrassing if you ever sit in the car with me. It's really bad. What I'm doing is I've just momentarily got an idol in my head that I need to get somewhere on time, and that thing has overruled any normal way of operating that I have at that moment. Any normal way of being nice or kind or patient or loving or self-controlled or anything, that idol, that small momentary thing, I've got to get there on time, that overrules everything. And that's in a way what an idol does. An idol is something that starts acting as a god for us. Now, in the Old Testament, the Bible and so on, basically, I heard a great line about it and I want to give it to you. The idols they made were quite concrete and physical. The great line I heard, maybe you've heard it too, was that an idol always conceals more than it reveals. An idol conceals more than it reveals. And the idea is, you know, if you made an idol of God that was like a cuddly lamb, well, I guess that would represent God's gentleness, but it wouldn't get God's greatness. It would reveal a bit, but it would conceal a whole lot more. And let's say if you like the Israelites who are saved, and then Moses goes to meet with God, and the thing they make is a golden calf. Now, it's not an insult of an idol to God. They don't go and make a mouse, right? They make a golden calf. That's a picture of, you know, of fertility, but also of strength. So it's a picture that gets the strength of God, but it doesn't get any of the other aspects of God at all. And that's one of the main problems. They conceal more than they reveal, and idols box and restrain God. They restrict God. And it both does it physically and symbolically and metaphorically. It also does it in that you're there and you do your worship with the idol. And then in a sense, you can kind of pull away and you've done your bit with the idol and you've boxed God there and you try to live the rest of your life without it. Of course, that doesn't happen. And our life is affected by not only that idol, but all the other things that we value and appreciate and think are important and are God's. Just go back to verse 7 for a second. This is a bit interesting. I don't know whether you thought of this as you had it read it. Paul's warning them about idolatry, okay? Look at verse 7 again. Look at verse 7. He says, and then look at what he quotes, verse 7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. You kind of go, Paul, mate, like, why quote that verse? What for? I'm a school teacher, so I take on some of my students' language sometimes, and that's what they say in year 9. What for, sir? Anyway, what for, Paul? Paul here, verse 7. What for? Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, he should say, the people made a golden calf, right? That golden calf idolaters, right? That would make sense, right? Paul here, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in that sounds more like recess at my school. Do you know what I mean? The kids, you know, eat, drink, eat their food, and then off they go and run around and try and kill each other on the roof, you know? That's what it would be. What we think's going on, I reckon, is you've got to remember the context of chapter 8, 9, and 10. The context is, remember, the whole eating meat sacrifice to idols. And so Paul's got in mind this Corinthian church that is living in a culture that often when you go to celebrate with people and you become part of their feasts, you eat at the temple. And at the temple, you eat and drink. And then things get a bit weird and crazy and all sorts of stuff goes on there. And I don't want to fill your minds with what we know happened at various times, but some pretty strange stuff happened. That's the kind of context I think he's going on. And it's true as well to Exodus and what happened back there. I think what Paul is bringing up is the fact that, not just the fact that there's an idol there, but he's bringing up all the behavior that flows from idolatry. And that's it, what it seems to be in verse 7. People sat down to eat and drink and they got up to indulge in revelry. And there's a big sexual innuendo there. You know, normally you feel a bit guilty about sexual innuendo. No, it's pure sexual innuendo there. There's lots of stuff happening. And that was very much associated with idol worship and that sort of stuff back then. So, Paul clearly wants them to think about what happens in them when they get associated with all this behavior that flows from idol worship. Well, it seems like, we'll go through some of this, but even just at the start, it seems like what happens with idolatry is you end up mentally making a god that you're more happy with, right? You end up making God. There's a whole bunch of different idolatries. You can do this. I talk to students sometimes, and they'll say to me about their picture about God. They'll say, I like to think of God as unconditional love. Or I like to think of God as a kind of higher being or power and that sort of stuff. And I think the trick with that is, isn't it? It's the I like to think. You see, if you come up to me and you say to me, I like to think of you as a kind of nice, generous person who's going to give me $20. You know what I mean? I'm not going to be that interested in what you're saying sort of thing. I might be generous. They might be nice. But I want to be who I am. I want you to appreciate me for who I am. When we start to think about God as if we can make up our own idea of God, I like to think of God as, we're starting to get on dangerous territory. And that is a kind of form of mental idolatry. And we mentally make God the way we want God to be. Usually we make God without any anger or judgment or any consequences. Usually we make God as a kind of genie or something. But the God here is clearly bigger than our little pictures. And this God here gives consequences for people who just ignore God or forget about God or make up their own ideas of God. That's the kind of mental idea of God. And God can't be boxed. You hear some of that language there. It seems like a pretty dangerous thing to make up your own picture of God and then say that's what God's like. It seems like the Bible's claim is that God reveals himself through the Bible. Now, we can have mental images of God, but we can also have our physical ideas about God. Now, we can have, this is what we're talking about in terms of our loves. Worship comes from a Latin word that means ascribe value to, okay? Ascribe worth, worship worth is kind of where the word comes from. And so, worship is whatever you love and serve and value and prioritize and are devoted to. That's what worship means, and that's what an idol can be. An idol could be back there, it could be a physical representation of something. It can also, as easily for all of us in our society, be something that our desires focus on. The truth is, I guess, what the Bible is saying is, for many people, you may think that when you don't worship God, that you don't worship anything. But when you don't worship God, it's not that you worship nothing, it's that you worship anything. Anything becomes fair game to be an idol, to be something you give yourself to, you give your loves to in a small way. And I think that's because in the Bible, humans are created to be worshippers of God. You can see it in Genesis 1. They're created to be representatives of God on earth, and they're also created to praise God. They're created to love the stuff, but to honor God. And the problem, as Romans 1:25 says, humans exchange the truth about God for a lie and worship and serve created things rather than the Creator. Now, does that kind of get it? We tend to worship created things instead of using and enjoying them and honoring God. And I think this happens in all sorts of ways. It happens when you're late in the car on the way somewhere. It happens in that humans, we tend to be a bit compulsive about stuff. Have you realized this? You see it in addictions. You know, if you're addicted to alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, whatever you're addicted to, we kind of get a bit compulsive. But we can tend to be addicted to other stuff. Do you guys watch many DVD series? Can you put up your hand if that is your primary method of watching and consuming TV? Is that a kind of big thing for many people here? Yeah. TV's a bit unreliable, ads, all that sort of stuff. DVD series are where it's at. Have you ever found, maybe this is just me, but I'm interested in this as an experiment. Have you ever found, once you start watching a DVD series, you kind of move from one a night to kind of two a night sometimes? Do you know you have that conversation at the end of that particular episode? You kind of look to the other person, you'll be like one more, you know, and you just kind of watch it again sort of thing. And if it's an hour-long episode, that's pretty brutal, but you're like, one more, you know. And you do that. And then you get to this stage where a night really isn't complete without watching an hour of a DVD, right? You get home late, 9:30, 10 o'clock, and you're still, your whole calculations about when you get home is, how many episodes? That's only going to be two episodes. That's okay, you know, I can still get two in. Do you see, anything we do kind of tends to creep in and become something that sort of has an impact on our behavior. It starts to influence us. And the thing is, they always start small, but they start big, but then they get big and they really influence us. That's what idolatry is. I think you can see it in there in the small things and in the big things in our passage. Let me go on before a couple of things. There's all sorts of little things. I told some of you I really like running, and you're like, are you kidding? Could running be an idol? Like, how sad are you? You know, that is pretty bad. But you know what? It just comes in a subtle way. It just starts becoming more and more of your life. It starts taking out more and more of your time. You start prioritizing it more and more. Next thing you know, it's influencing your decisions. Idolatry, in the end, becomes enslavement to something we love. Now, we usually love good things. And many of these things are good. You see there verse 8. Verse 8, he says, we should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. and in one day 23,000 of them died. See, one of the things he emphasizes here is one of the best things. Sex is one of the best things God has created, right? It is really good. The Bible is very pro-sex, as you know. It's quite, you know, the picture at the start is this beautiful picture, both of physical and spiritual and emotional and or sexual coming together of the man and the woman in Genesis 2. You know, read that picture and then go to Song of Solomon and read that picture of the glowing way the Bible talks about sex. So the Bible's never anti-sex. It is anti-sexual immorality, which is sex outside of that beautiful marriage that it describes there. And so I think one of the reasons now it comes out here is because sex is one of those things that's so good, it's easy for us to push from being good to being God. And it can do it with us, and it really impacts us, and it shapes us. It shapes us in whether it's internet porn, whether it's stuff that we read and we're influenced by, it shapes us in all sorts of ways. And that's the thing with idolatry. It's very rarely bad stuff. Always good stuff that we've just pushed up into God stuff. That's what idolatry is, and that's what idolatry does. It could be we might love our spouse, our kids, our job, our boyfriend or girlfriend, our looks, our flat, our car, our travel, our coffee, our favorite pub. Could be our friends. There is literally, you know, people have done studies on this. There is no end to the amount of things we can idolize. They're all good, but we've just made them God. And if you ever want to think about this for yourself, I'll give you a couple of questions and maybe you can go away and think about them for yourself. What do you long for, care about, or are passionate about? That can often be a little key to kind of something. Where do you go for comfort? You know, when life sucks, when you've had a really bad day and you kind of get home, where do you go to kind of pull you up a bit out of the negative? Where do you go? You might go food, you know, you may go, I don't know, alcohol, sex, could be shopping. Shopping's always good. Where do you go? That can be something. What's the most important thing people, you think people need to know about you? Hi, my name's Josh and I do something. Maybe your job is what you need to describe. Or you like to introduce people to your partner or your flat. Maybe that's it. Here's another question that helps us figure out what's an idol. What are you mad or angry at God about? You know how, you know, we kind of think, God, you really, I know you're not supposed to talk about being mad or angry at God, but we get that way, right? And we want to say, why are you angry about God? What are you angry about? What are you angry about? Well, because God didn't really do his job, okay? He's doing a bad job of being God. God, I want to be married. And right there, that could be your idol, a spouse. Where are they? Where is this person that I want to get married to? What kind of God are you? You're really not great at taking orders, right? And maybe you really need to sort yourself out. But what are you mad or angry at God about? What do you sacrifice the most in your life? What do you kind of prioritize above other else? What do you, whose approval do you seek? What do you fear losing? These are all things there. They're all things that can be idols. And you know, I reckon one of the worst things about idols is, worst thing about them is, they're all works-based. You are always trying to get them. They work. And the problem is you just have to move on to the next one. Once you've got something, you move on to the next one. You know, you work really, really hard to kind of get that girlfriend. Then you work really, really hard to get married, and that was your idol. And then your next idol is to having kids. You work really, really hard. Then your next idol is to get a house, and that's then you work really, really hard towards that. You're just working really hard all the time. And then the idol just moves on to the next thing, and you need something else. It's just kind of what happens. Whereas God is a good God who loves us, who has so much better for us than that sort of thing. God is so much better than an idol that we keep having to chase and keep having to kind of move on and do to the next thing. We see there, I should sort of hurry up because you guys have had a long weekend. We see a couple of things there. We see we should not test Christ as some of them did. That's a kind of a making God do our thing. Right? This is what I need God in this way, and if you haven't done this, that's not good enough. That's what that kind of thing is. That's forcing God to fix your problems. That's making God into a genie. That's the kind of testing. And then verse 10, do not grumble as some of them did. Now, you wouldn't think grumble would make that list. I know, it's kind of surprising, like grumbling. Is grumbling really that bad a thing to do? You know, if you're in, you'd never want to be in jail for grumbling, would you? Like, that'd be embarrassing. You know, like, what are you in here for? Murder. Oh, what are you in here for? Grumbling, you know. Ooh, tough guy, you know. Like, it's embarrassing as a particular bad thing to do, but it's a funny thing. Grumbling can really define who you are. And actually, I think grumbling is one of those subtle things that shows who you love. Because if you love something else, then you'll always be grumbling to God because you don't have that other thing, right? That's the way you relate to God. You'll be a grumbler. And as you get on in life, as life goes on and on and on, you tend to either become a horrible, old, bitter grump, or you tend to become a thankful, gentle, wonderful kind of Christian, mature person. And see, the key of this whole thing, I think, the key is not actually in these verses here, I think. The key is not right here. Let me hold off on that key for a second and then we'll finish. The key is, I think, Paul says this stuff here as warnings for us, okay? And he says a warning in verse 12 and 13. It's a warning to two types of people listening. If you're just sort of sitting there and you kind of think, you know, I'm all sorted. I don't need to worry too much. Then Paul's saying, if you think you're standing firm, be careful. Don't be proud. Don't think I've got this all sorted out. Oh, idolatry, you know, that's for kind of other people. I'm aware of this. If you don't know the things that you are tempted to idolize and love, then you're not standing very firm. You need to be aware of these. So if you're standing, if you're complacent, hear that warning. But you know what? If you're a super warrior, then verse 13 is helpful here. It says, no temptation has overtaken you except what's common to mankind. God is faithful. God is faithful. God's got your back. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. When you're tempted, He'll provide a way out so you can endure it. You see, God will help us in our struggles. If we continually bring these things to God, He'll help us. I think with idolatry, I reckon what we need to do, we need to identify it. So seriously, if you can think in your life, what are the things I'm really tempted to love more than God? Identify them. Pray to God to help you with them. And then verse 31, can you listen to this? This is beautiful. And the key to hearing commands in the Bible, here's the key. Verse 31 is not on your readings, but here is the key to reading commands in the Bible. You don't read them as commands, you read them as invitations. That's how you read them. Listen to verse 31. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. You see, you could hear that if you're a normal sort of works thinking way of, you know, think I justify my relationship with God by what I do. You could hear that as a command. Do all, everything you do, do it for the glory of God. But of course, when God's your Father, when God saved you, when you love God and you appreciate His stuff, you know this is an invitation. This is an invitation to keep everything in perspective. This is an invitation to whatever you do to give thanks to God for it. You know, if something comes along, you're thankful to God for it. And you don't let it get out of perspective and start ruling your life. You're thankful for your job. You don't let it become too big and become something that now it dictates all your decisions. You're thankful to God for it. And I think if you're struggling with something and that's really taken over your heart and your desires, whenever you think about that thing, start thinking and start saying, dear God, thank you for this thing. Because it immediately starts putting it in its place and helping you to understand it, to love it for what it is and not make it bigger than it is. I'm going to finish and pray. And then, I don't know if we'll have time for questions or not, but let's finish and let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that in the midst of a society like ours that has so much good in it, Lord, so much to appreciate, so much to be thankful for, so much to just glorify you for, Lord, in the midst of that society, we are tempted to desire stuff and to prioritize stuff above you and to love stuff more than we love you. And yet, Lord, you speak to us in your word. You warn us like we've been warned here tonight. And you remind us, don't make your good stuff you've given us the God stuff. Lord, help us to have you as our God. Help us to be ruled by you. Help us to enjoy that kind, beneficent, loving, caring rule that you have over our lives. Lord, help us to love you more than any of these other things we see. And Lord, as we struggle with this, help us to look to Jesus. Help us to look to Jesus who showed us how to do this, who showed us a life that didn't avoid good stuff as if it was somehow bad in itself, but that rejoiced in it and enjoyed it, and yet showed where his love and willingness to serve was. And that was in you and your people. Heavenly Father, help us as we think about this. Help us to love you more than stuff. And help this love for you to shape and keep in perspective our love for other things. Amen.